Good morning. We are so pleased to have Audrey Bowden come speak to us today. She is an assistant professor of electrical engineering at Stanford University. She holds a bachelor's of science in engineering and electrical engineering from Princeton University, a PhD in the biomedical engineering from Duke University, and completed postdoctoral training in chemistry and chemical biology at Harvard University. She also spent a short time as an international fellow in Singapore and as a legislative assistant in the United States Senate through the American Association for the Advancement of Science and Technology Policy Fellows Program sponsored by the OSA and SPIE. Bowden directs the Stanford Biomedical Optics Group, whose mission is to develop and deploy novel tools for optical imaging at the microscale and nanoscale. The group also has a particular interest in the development of low-cost, portable technologies suited for use in poorly resourced environments. Welcome, Audrey.
Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Yes, in the back? Okay, great. Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you to Mike, who invited me, and to all of you who've expressed anticipation for my talk, which has made me more nervous than I thought I would be, but I hope I can deliver something that is helpful and reflective for all of you. I've been praying to God about what to speak. And so this is somewhat of an unusual talk for me, I think. And so I'm looking forward to sharing in this dialogue with you. I also want to thank Heather for that beautiful devotion, which only God planned as the introduction to my talk. So thank you so much. And I'm going to take a lot from that. And it really does, I hope, tie in very nicely to what I want to say. So
can you speak louder?
Oh, OK. Is the microphone on? This one. Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. I guess I won't move. Okay. So the title of my talk today is Imaging or Imagining a Bright Future for Healthcare. And so that connects with my background and my interest. So the work that I do is in medical imaging. And what I wanted to say, as I mentioned, was that I was praying about what to speak about and how to share what I do, but also aspects of my faith journey and my continuing faith walk as I go through this work. And so what I wanted to do was start a little bit with my background and how I got to where I am. And I hope, especially for the students in this room, you've heard a little bit of my biography. It's a little bit circuitous and unusual, so hopefully that will be inspiring and comforting to some of you. So I'll start with high school. So I went to a science and math magnet high school, and it was a great place to grow up and develop. Very early on, I got involved in research as a high school student, but I also had a lot of different interests. So I was an athlete, a three-sport athlete, actually, in high school, and I also loved languages and French, and so I loved kind of thinking about traveling and studying abroad, though I didn't get a chance to do that in high school particularly. In high school, as I mentioned, I studied science and math. I was a magnet school for that, and so I didn't really know what engineering was, but everyone said, oh, you like science and math, you should be an engineer. And I said, okay, that sounds interesting. So I applied to college for engineering, and I decided to go to Princeton, which was relatively close to home. I'm from New Jersey. And at Princeton, I ultimately decided to study electrical engineering. It was mostly a process of elimination. I knew what I didn't like. It was really hard for me to necessarily say I fell in love with this, but kind of by process of elimination, I ended up studying electrical engineering, and I did enjoy it. And at some point in my career, I had to make a choice about how to delve into a particular area of electrical engineering. And one of the things that fascinated me a lot was the study of light. And so I studied optics as an undergraduate. I also was an athlete in college, so I started out rowing on the crew team because I thought that it would give me big muscles. And after about a year, when I learned that people
can break their ribs rowing, I decided to try a safer sport and I played rugby for the next much to the chagrin of my parents. And as you can see, you know, I went to a liberal arts school, so I took a diversity of classes while I was in college. And afterwards, I really wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I had always had this interest in languages, as I mentioned, but I didn't get a chance to really pursue that as a student. So I wanted a broad experience. And so I applied for a program to teach abroad, which ultimately took me to Singapore. So while I was in Singapore, I was teaching math and computer science, and I also had a chance to travel a lot, so it worked out very, very well. And Singapore was actually quite a formative time for my faith as well, because the church that I attended was a relatively young church, it was quite large, but the majority of the people in that church were under 25. And it was an amazing experience because the majority of those people actually came from families where they didn't have Christians as parents, and I had grown up in a Christian home. And so it was quite amazing just being around other young adults who were so passionate for Christ, whose faith was so clearly their own. It wasn't something that they had just grown up with. They decided they were constantly fighting with their families about being Christians, and so that really inspired and helped grow me. Well, after Singapore, I went to graduate school. I went to Duke, and while I was at Duke, I studied biomedical optics. So in high school, I had actually become interested in healthcare and bioengineering, but I knew I didn't want to be a doctor, and I knew I wanted to do something else, so grad school was where I had a chance to merge those two things together. So I studied biomedical optics, so I was working on optics, but for the purposes of medical applications. And the pictures that you can see up here just represent other aspects of my life. So. To be perfectly honest, I had found college quite difficult, and so I thought when I got to graduate school, I needed to relax a little bit and try a bunch of different things, and so I wasn't your typical graduate student, always in the lab. Sorry, maybe some of you should close your ears about this, but so I did a lot of other things. I was president of student council, I went to basketball games, I was on a salsa team with undergrads, which was really weird because they like to practice at 10 p.m. at night, and as you guys saw, I go to bed at 9:30. But it was a great time, and oftentimes I say that graduate school was the best days and the worst days of my life. Because it was the best days, I really enjoyed it, but in graduate school, well, graduate school is just hard. All of you know that, right? There are days when you just face failure after failure, you question yourself and who you are and all these things. Well, I wasn't sure in going to graduate school that I actually wanted to follow an academic career path. So I spent a lot of time searching and looking for other things to do. And one of those things that I stumbled upon was public policy. And I had one of those moments where I learned about public policy and I thought, wow, that sounds really great and really interesting. Maybe I should go do that after graduate school. So I did. I joined a program called the IISS Science and Technology Policy Fellows Program, which took me to Washington for the year, and I worked in the Senate. And so I was a legislative assistant, got to see and work on national policy right around the time when the economy was pretty much tanking. So it was a really interesting time to be in Washington. There was a lot of focus on the housing market and what was changing and new policies. And so, you know, I really enjoyed it. But for reasons that I'll share later on, I knew that God was actually calling me to a different path. So I went to Washington knowing that I would only be there for 1 year. During that year as well, I got a chance to do some short-term mission work and really connected with the idea of providing and servicing the poor and people who don't have infrastructure. And that partly influenced my decision later to do a postdoc after this fellowship at Harvard, where I worked for a professor who had a pretty big research effort on global healthcare technologies. And so he had a company called Diagnostics for All, where essentially one of the taglines was simple solutions and zero cost diagnostics. So we were working on things that were really intended to help and assist places that didn't have access to resources, that didn't have consistent electricity. I had a chance to travel to Haiti and help deploy some of these devices. So it was a really wonderful opportunity. And then after that, I started at Stanford, so I've been at Stanford for several years now. As you heard, I'm an assistant professor. I have my own lab working on biomedical optics, and so our focus is on optical tools for imaging and sensing, and we do a little bit of work in low-cost portal technologies that's kind of growing right now. Now, all of that sounds like a pretty smooth story, even though it kind of has some twists and turns in it, but that's not really how it worked. The path of my call, like many of us, I think, was one of following open doors, listening to encouraging words, and taking leaps of faith. I think the fact of the matter is that for a lot of my life, I felt inadequate and unprepared for the next step that God was calling me to, and each one of these was a new step. So I mentioned in high school, you know, I was in a science and math high school, and I was told to go into engineering, but I actually went into engineering not really knowing what it was. I decided to pursue that path, even though I had no clear understanding of what that would look like. I decided to go to Princeton, actually, even though I had originally told myself I didn't want to go to Princeton because it was too close to home. An unusual thing about my high school was I was one of the second, I was in the second graduating class, but my school, they actually had no one who'd gone to Princeton yet. It was a New Jersey school, so they felt they had to have someone who went to Princeton. And so I felt this burden, and I decided to go, but you know, the amazing thing was God met me there. And as soon as I got to campus, I remember the first day I walked into my dorm, and underneath my door, there was a flyer that said, "Are you looking for God on campus?" And I said, "Yes," and he was there. Now, the next step from Princeton to graduate school, actually, the reason I went to graduate school was because my dad told me that I had to. He took me for a walk one day and said, "You have to go to graduate school and get at least a master's, and I'm not going to pay for it." And so I said, okay, I have to go to graduate school, and I applied for master's programs everywhere. I thought, wow, it would be cool to be a doctor someday, but I really had very little confidence that I would get into a PhD program. And so the interesting thing is I didn't apply for PhD programs anywhere. And everywhere I applied, I got into a PhD program. So I was accepted to Duke, among other places. And the interesting thing about my story at Duke was I went to Duke, during my kind of visit and interview at Duke, I had a very influential interview with the dean of the school at the time, which was a bit unusual for a student to be interviewed by the dean during their visit. God set up so many unusual things. And this person happened to have gone to Stanford. She was a Stanford alum. And during one of my conversations with her, I left her office just feeling like, wow, like this, I want to emulate this woman. She's so wonderful. And I really actually wanted to go to Stanford for graduate school. I had applied and had gotten in. But I left that meeting thinking, well, if God really wants me at Stanford, then somehow he'll bring me back there. And I decided to go to Duke, close the door, and I never thought about it again. As I mentioned, when I was in graduate school, I had not really intended to pursue an academic career, and so I was planning to do all these other things. And it was that dean, who happened to be a Stanford alum, who happened to sit on the committee of the advisory board of the electrical engineering department at Stanford, who happened to tell them about me when they were looking for a faculty candidate. And they contacted me and said, "Hey, we heard you might be interested in applying for this job." And I said, "No." Where did you hear that from? And I remembered in that moment that I had heard that voice 5, 6, 7 years before, that if God really wants me at Stanford, that somehow he'll bring me back there. And that was the only reason that I decided to apply. And so I applied to Stanford, and I got the job, surprisingly, to me anyway. And I knew once I got it, I had to go. That was an open door that God had provided for me, and he intended for me to be there. And so I put that before my trip to Harvard, because I actually knew I was going to Stanford before I ended up doing my postdoc at Harvard, which itself was another God moment of planting and planning for me to be there. So anyway, that's a little bit about my call. And so I really feel like my work at Stanford has been a call to ministry. God called me there, and the only reason I'm there, the only reason I went there, is because I feel like God had put it on my heart and opened the doors for me to be there. So some of you might have that experience or might not have had that experience, but just to encourage all of you, just as you walk through open doors, that God will meet you there. Okay, so a little bit about the work that I do. Let me first make a case for imaging work. And I'll take a few verses from the Bible. So Matthew 6, verses 22 to 23. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light that is within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? The Bible, as we've heard, contains so many different metaphors for light and sight and vision and seeing, and I think it's so wonderful. And for me, it's really makes part of my work a spiritual experience every day that I get to work with this technology that I think is so close to what the biblical text talks about. And so what I think about this passage is that it's really telling us it's important to see. It's important to basically create images and be able to see what's inside. And a case for light, well, light is at the very heart of who God is and what he is, right? He tells us, this is the message we've heard from him and declare to you, that God is light and in him there is no darkness at all. So why do we use light for medical imaging? Well, light has a lot of different properties that are actually quite valuable for medical imaging. Well, first of all, if you're going to image the body or do something in healthcare, you don't want to kill people. So the optical photons that we work with, at least in the regimes that I work with, are generally non-ionizing, which means that they're not harmful. I don't do X-ray work or DPV or anything like that. So these light waves basically just go through the body, and they're not harmful, and at least in the doses that we use, which is good. The wavelengths of optics allow us to get high resolution or to see very small details, which we often need because a lot of things start out very small and we want to catch them at their earliest stage. The spectrum of optics is so rich and it can tell us a lot of information about what we're actually seeing. So light interacts with the body, and the interaction that it has tells us about what's happening in the body, what's present in the body, what molecules are there that are supposed to be there or that are not supposed to be there. We can also use changes in the amount of light that's absorbed, meaning how much light doesn't come back to us when we're looking for it, to tell us something about the function of what's happening. So is your heart beating? Is there blood moving? How fast is that blood moving? All of these are what we call functional exceptions or functional imaging. How light scatters in the body can tell us something about the sizes of the things that we're interacting with. So for example, it turns out that in cancer, one of the hallmarks of cancer is that the nucleus enlarges, and when the nucleus enlarges, it becomes a scattering particle that scatters light in a very different way. So one way that we can detect the presence of cancer is by looking at changes in the scattering properties of light. Another property of light is its polarization, which I'll talk a little bit about later. Polarization really just relates to the orientation of light in space. And it can tell us about structural properties, so it's something ordered and organized, are things very horizontal, are they disordered, and that can be important as well for information like early cancer diagnostics. We can look at frequency shifts for flow, and of course the high power beams of lasers can be used for therapeutic applications like ablating, and then of course, as I mentioned before, light is inherently sterile, which is a good thing when you're working with people. One of the technologies that I work with primarily is something called optical coherence tomography, or OCT. So how many of you have heard of OCT before, just by show of hands? Okay, a few people, right? So OCT is an imaging technique similar to other medical imaging techniques that you might have heard of, like X-ray imaging, MRI, ultrasound, PT scan, PET scans, etc. So what distinguishes OCT from these other techniques has to do with various properties, like its resolution. So it can see details that are around 10 microns or so, which is pretty small. We can get really high time resolution images, so we can see things really fast. We can create almost three-dimensional volumes or see things in pretty much real time. We can image about 1 centimeter into the body, so we can't see through the whole body, but we can see kind of shallow depths. And depending on how we design our probes, for example, we can make them minimally invasive. So we can design an OCT probe to fit inside of an endoscope that the doctor might feed inside of your body. So even though we can see only 1 centimeter in, we can see it from the inside, or we can look it in from the outside. So this graph on the, your right, my right, on my left, your right, basically shows the difference in spatial resolution of different technologies versus how deeply into the body the technology can penetrate. So OCT fits kind of right in the middle. So I can't see as deeply as MRI and ultrasound, but we can get good high-level details. So oftentimes people like to say that with OCT or with MRI and ultrasound, we're kind of imaging the body on the scale of the human body. So the types of features that we can see are human-sized features, whereas with OCT, we can see comparable features but in a much, much smaller animal model like the mouse. So OCT basically takes light, and we're trying to use that light to see what's happening inside of the body. The body, it turns out, is a reflector. Isn't that amazing that we were designed to reflect light? So what we do is we send light in. You can see it. So there's a light wave that comes inside of the body. And the body's actually a multi-layered reflector. So it's kind of like a series of partially reflective mirrors. So as that light comes in, it interacts with the body, and at various layers, a portion of that light reflects back. And so what we do is we measure when that light reflects back and how much light reflects back from each layer. And based on that, we can figure out where the layers are and something about their composition or the differences between those two layers. So in general, OCT works by using this source of backscattering signal. The measurement that we make is essentially a time of flight measurement, as I mentioned. But we don't measure the time of flight directly. Light travels a little too fast for that. So we use indirect methods called interferometry. And the types of light sources that we typically use for OCT are in the infrared regime, so roughly 800 or 1300 nanometers. So for those of you who aren't calibrated to that, visible wavelengths are roughly 400 to 700 nanometers. So infrared wavelengths are slightly longer than that. Another key aspect of the light sources that we don't use classic lasers. We use lasers that have what's called a broad bandwidth, so they emit a lot of different wavelengths at the same time, and it's this broad bandwidth or spectrum of light that allows us to actually section inside of the body and to see the different layers. So the picture that you see on the right is an example of an image that you might see with OCT. So light comes in, and what you're seeing is a cross-sectional image. So for example, if I were to image your hand under OCT, we wouldn't see the palm of your hand. We'd actually see a slice through your hand and the different layers of skin and other fat and other materials inside. So light comes in, as I mentioned, it reflects back at different layers inside of the body. We measure how much light reflects back and also the timing of that, and that we generate what we call an A scan, which is the line telling us where the light reflects and how much. And then we do that over and over and over again for different parts of the body. And we generate a full two-dimensional image, so we get what's called a B-scan. So ultimately, the types of images that we can get are three dimensions. So what you're seeing on the left-hand side on the top is an OCT image of a finger. So this will work. So you can see these kind of undulations that I'm trying to point out here. Those would be the ridges and valleys of your fingerprint. But what's important is we're not just seeing the surface of your finger, we're actually able to see what's inside. So the subsurface of your finger, so the epidermis, dermis layer, in fact, these curlicule structures right here are sweat ducts. So if you were looking at this a live image, you should be able to see sweat evaporating from inside of your body. And on the right-hand side, you're seeing a picture of an eye captured with OCT. So this looks like any image that you might capture with a camera, but remember that we can slice this image in any direction. So at the bottom, you're seeing a slice across this eye, taking something like this. So you can see the front surface of the eye or the cornea. Here's the lens that we were talking about earlier today in the human eye. The retina, which is the very, very back visual processing center of the eye, would be somewhere closer to the bottom. So OCT is a technology that's actually been deployed in many different areas, including in ophthalmic clinics. I don't know if any of you have ever had an OCT scan of your eye before. Anyone? One or two people, yeah. So it's actually now become, it's a pretty young technology, but the researchers have pushed it so hard that it's actually been clinically accepted as a gold standard imaging technique for looking at the back of the eye and basically to look at, in particular, retinal pathologies. It's also being used in cardiology and a number of different areas for all the reasons that are listed on the right-hand side. A few other applications of OCT besides ophthalmology and cardiology include developmental biology. So again, it's non-invasive, so we can easily do longitudinal studies over small animals. It's being explored as an alternative to x-rays in dentistry, even in pharmacology, art conservation for being able to see below the surface of a picture without actually destroying the picture, and other things like that. So to get into a little bit of one of the problems that I work on, birefringence is a property of materials that basically takes light of a certain orientation and can change that orientation. And so what we want to measure is this change in orientation of light. The orientation of light is something that we call polarization. And there are a lot of different materials in your body that have exhibit birefringence, particularly your muscles commonly exhibit birefringence, but also your skin. And birefringence actually can tell you something about how orderly the structure is of a particular material. So if the muscles are nicely oriented and aligned, then they're going to show one signal. If they start to be disarrayed and disordered, they're going to show another signal. And so that's what we're actually looking for in our studies of skin. And what we're studying is skin cancer. So skin cancer is a prevalent, but it is a treatable disease if it's caught early enough. So there are over 3.5 million new cases in the US. And the way that it's often detected is usually by visual inspection. So you go to a primary care physician, they see something that they think looks suspicious, and if they think it's too suspicious, they'll take you to the doctor, the dermatologist, and they'll do a biopsy to actually remove some of it. Now, this is okay if it's occurring in some part of your body that's not visible, but a lot of the skin cancers actually feature in prominent places like the face and neck, places that you really don't want to have a lot of biopsies. And so this wouldn't be an ideal technology. What we're looking at in particular are basal cell carcinomas. So basal cell carcinomas, or BCC cancers, are the most commonly occurring form of skin cancer, so roughly comprise about 80% of all skin cancers. And they can be quite disfiguring and discomforting. So this is just showing you a picture of the skin, where you can see the different layers, the epidermis, dermis, and some fatty tissue below. And the basal cells are located at the boundary, essentially, between the epidermis and the dermis. So basal cell carcinoma is essentially a form of cancer that originates in the basal cell. There are other types of cancers that originate by other cells in the skin. So in terms of the clinical needs, what we really like to do is provide the primary care physician with tools that they can use before it has to go to the dermatologist to detect the cancer non-invasively, be highly sensitive, because the primary care physicians aren't as trained to detect and know what is cancer as a dermatologist. But how many people have tried to get an appointment with a dermatologist before? They're not always accessible when you think they should be. So we really would like to provide some tools that might work in the primary care suite. So we want this diagnostic to be highly sensitive and, of course, automated, because one of the barriers to introducing new technologies in the hospital is training the physicians and getting them used to and oriented to something that they've never worked with or never seen before and has to work better than whatever they've been using currently. Ultimately, we, of course, love this to be low cost, but that's not something that we're working on right now. So we're looking at basal cell carcinoma, and our goal is to detect the basal cell carcinoma at the earliest stages, so to do early cancer diagnostics. And so as I mentioned, the basal cells are in the subsurface of the skin, so they originate at the epidermis-dermis boundary. Well, OCT can actually detect things below the surface of the skin, so it sounds like a perfect match. So this is a picture of normal mouse skin, and the image that you're seeing on the left is a histology image, which is essentially a slide that they've made of tissue. And so you can see some of the features of the skin that the doctor would normally use and look at to detect cancer. This is an OCT image of a similar piece of normal skin. And so we can capture these cross-sectional images, what are called B-scans, using OCT, and we can differentiate them from scans that have cancer. So you can see on the bottom where we have a tumor. This tumor shows prominently here. And then it shows the area of intensity contrast in the OCT image as well. So OCT has a decent resolution to be able to detect these types of things, good imaging depth. However, what we found is that when people were using traditional OCT, they were only able to achieve sensitivities below 90%, sensitivities and specificities. And these are two metrics that doctors often use to determine how well is the technology performing. And they want something that's better than 90% most of the time. So what we found is that by adding information about the orientation of the various collagen fibers that are in the skin, which is detectable using birefringence, we can actually improve this sensitivity and specificity. So we did an initial test of this in mouse. And so what you're seeing here is the polarization contrast image from the OCT. The colors basically tell you something about the birefringence properties. And again, you can see in the tumor image, we have areas of low birefringence. And so what we were interested in is figuring out to what degree this change in birefringence gives us additional contrast that we can use to better identify which images are going to be healthy versus which images are going to be cancer. So we want to do this ultimately in an automated way. So our goal was to extend our work from BCCs in mouse to human skin, develop automated techniques that can be used by the doctors, and make sure that it's non-invasive and highly sensitive. Ultimately, we hope that we can eliminate the need for biopsy altogether, so that people who don't actually have skin cancer don't have to have a biopsy. So just a quick overview of some of the methods that we use. In our lab, we developed a system to do the imaging. And then we're going to use some advanced computer vision techniques to build a classifier, which is going to allow us to automatically detect whether there's cancer or not cancer in an image. And then, of course, we're going to test our classifier. So the main procedure that we go through is we capture these unused pieces from Mohs surgery, which is one of the most common surgeries used to treat skin cancer. So we get them from human tissues. We take these samples. This was an ex vivo study. We take these samples, we image them with polarization sensitive OCT. We capture a number of different images. So we capture images from healthy patients. We capture images from patients who have BCC. So we capture a total large number of images. For those of you who are interested, the system that we use looks something like this. So it's an interferometer. Let's see if I can walk you through those of you who are, might be interested. So here's the light source. It gets split into a reference arm and a sample arm. This is a Mach-Zehnder interferometer configuration. Here's our detector, which is a polarization-sensitive polarization balancing detector. So we have two detectors to detect the horizontal and vertical channels of the polarized light. And we're using single-input polarization state system, single-mode fiber, which is intended to make the system more portable. So these are the types of images that we get. So on the top left, you can see an example of the histology, and then the OCT images for intensity, and then the phase retardation and the birefringence contrast, which is a little bit more colorful. And you can see the contrast with BCC. Again, here we have this tumor. The tumor shows up here, but as you can see, the difference between the tumor and the normal skin is not that apparent when we're looking at the images in standard OCT. And that contrast increases when we look at the phase retardation image because, well, the colors go away. Colors basically tell us there's no birefringence, which means that everything has gotten scrambled. One of the challenges that we had with this set of samples is that there are actually many different subtypes of BCC, and so there's a large diversity in the types of images that we can capture. And so this is another type of BCC where you can see we have kind of two islands of tumors, and in the phase contrast image, phase retardation image, we actually don't have this single large mass of loss of birefringence. It actually appears in a more island form, and there's actually some colors here that might be suggestive of healthy. So on our own, we actually can't use our human discrimination to be able to figure this out easily, which is one of the reasons why we turn to the use of machine learning. So we build this classifier by capturing the images, extracting features from this from these images, and selecting features that are going to improve the accuracy, and we select a diversity of features. So the types of features that we get include what are called A-scan-based features and B-scan-based features, and I won't kind of belabor the point, I'll just kind of switch through. The idea of A-scan features is that we're looking at features that correspond to just a single line through the image, whereas with B-scan features, we look at features that correspond to some average or some information that's extracted from the whole image altogether. And then at the end of the day, the results that we get are really what matters. So we take all these features that we have. We want to select the best classifier that we can. So originally, we selected a classifier that has a lot of features from the images, so a total of 1,300 features, which is way too many features for a reasonable classifier. But then we go through several optimization rounds, and through this process, we ultimately end up with a smaller subset of features, which will allow us to actually run this classifier on the data in a much quicker time period. So then we choose which classifier we want, so there are a lot of different classifier options that we tested and went through. Ultimately, we ended up with a support vector machine with a Gaussian kernel. Again, that's kind of a detail for those of you who are interested. But at the end of the day, what's important is then we have this classifier whose goal is to take an image that it's never seen before and be able to predict, is this healthy or is this a cancerous image? And so using the intensity features only, we can get something that has accuracy that's similar to what others had gotten, so 70%, between 70 and 90%. When we do the phase retardation features, we actually can get something that's closer to 90%, which is what we're aiming for. And when we combine both feature sets, we can actually finally get something that's greater than 95%. So we have a classifier now that has a specificity and sensitivity of 95%, which is really, really promising. And another way of characterizing this data is by looking at what we call the receiving operator characteristic. So it's a curve that maps the sensitivity and the something related to the specificity on one axis, and you draw a line telling you something about the performance of your classifier. And basically you want this line to be drawn such that the area under the curve is as large as possible. So the metric that we're looking for is to maximize the area under the curve. And so what we found was that when we used intensity features only, we get an area less than 80%. With the phase retardation features, we get something close to 95%, and when we add both together, we get something close to 97%. So what this tells us is that we definitely have a method that is working towards being able to very accurately predict, you know, from these images whether or not we have cancer or healthy images, which is going to be useful for the primary care clinic. The study that we've done so far in this work has been ex vivo, and so our next step is to basically start testing this in the hospital. So we're setting up the protocols now, working with our clinicians to be able to take our new probe that we've designed that allows us to do this in a handheld fashion to go into the clinic and possibly determine, non-invasively if there's cancer or not in the images. Okay, so with that, I just want to do a quick time check. How am I doing? Okay, so I'll just mention one other project that we have on cancer just to round out this talk. So another project that we've been working on a lot has been thinking about visualizing and staging bladder cancer. So we've been working with a urologist, and this project actually has several components to it, like the previous one. So there's a hardware component where we need to develop new hardware technologies that allow us to get inside of the body and see cancer in its earliest form at the earliest stages. And then also we need software that allows us to better visualize and better register all this data together. So the challenge that we undertook, first of all, was designing a probe. We were going to use OCT for reasons that I won't enumerate right now. But designing a probe that could actually fit inside of the working channel of a cystoscope, which is an endoscope that goes inside of the bladder. Now the challenge there is that the flexible cystoscope has a really, really small working distance. Really, really small working channel, and so we needed to develop a probe that was smaller than what others had developed before. So that's part of the innovation that my lab does in engineering, is to develop these very, very small probes. So we develop, you know, these very small, fast, forward-moving probes that allow us to now go inside the bladder and look around. And I guess I didn't explain a little bit about why bladder cancer is important and what's kind of motivating us there. Well, one of the things that motivates us to think about bladder cancer is, it's the fifth most common form of cancer in general, probably fourth or fifth in men in the U.S. And one of the interesting facts I think about bladder cancer is actually its recurrence rate is very, very high. It's somewhere between 50 and 90%. So once you have bladder cancer, you are need to go under the monitoring for the rest of your life because the chances of you getting another incidence of bladder cancer are extremely high. As a consequence, you undergo this kind of diagnostic every 6 months to 1 year for the rest of your life. And because a portion of this is they're unable currently to avoid having you go into the operating room and you have to undergo anesthesia, it's very costly. So bladder cancer actually is the most costly form of cancer over a patient's lifetime of any cancer. So if we can do something to help with this earlier diagnostic, helping them to identify things that can prevent them from having to take the patients into the OR, we're going to reduce the cost of healthcare and then hopefully also help reduce a recurrence, because a lot of recurrence has to do with them not being able to identify the earliest stages of cancer. So we're working on that. We're developing probes that allow them to go inside and now see below the surface, which is where the cancer starts, so they can start to see the cancer before it actually makes it to the surface, which is where the tools that they currently have are limited to seeing. We've been doing some work as well to be able to take these very, very small probes that we have, which disadvantages that we have a small viewing area, but the bladder is relatively large, so we have to develop new algorithms that allow us to take these small viewing areas and stitch them over large areas so that we can get a more panoramic type view inside. So this is just an example image showing that we were able to develop a stitching algorithm to use a freehand probe and stitch together something that looks reasonable. And then the other thing that we've been thinking about is exploiting the data that's already collected during the cancer surveillance procedure and converting it into a format that allows the doctor to have a more convenient form of reviewing it. So right now, they collect all these videos, but they throw the videos away. They maybe keep a few images, write a few notes, but this is the video age, right? There's so much that we can be doing with video. So one of the things that we've been working on is taking these videos and using new computer vision algorithms to generate 3D models that allow them to go back, review the videos, and actually kind of redo a virtual surgery without having to go back into the patient. This will allow them to now compare surgeries over time and start to track in an easier way what's happening with the cancer. So I'll just skip over the end of that story, but just to mention two more things that we've been working on. So another project that we have in our lab is trying to understand how hearing works. So this is really important because almost everyone is going to start to have some form of hearing loss as they age. And one of the reasons why hearing aids are not as effective as they can be is because the only thing that hearing aids can do right now is they can increase the volume of noise or of sound in the room, but they can't actually help discriminate sounds any better. And so one of the things that we need to do in order to improve hearing aids is to understand better how does our brain naturally encode hearing information. So when we take sound in, it causes mechanical vibrations of various structures inside of the inner ear. And those vibrations somehow get transduced into signals that neurons, auditory neurons, can carry to the brain. But there's some mechanism that's happening in between that we don't fully understand. It's not a one-for-one vibration turns into an electrical pulse. So one of the things that we're trying to do is study the mechanics of the ear and understand how that vibration actually is related to the sounds that are coming in so that we can now make better connections between what we're hearing and what the brain is actually starting to understand. So we're doing this using OCT. So we've designed probes that can go inside of the ear and start to look at what's happening as we stimulate the ear with various sounds and look at the vibrations of the structures. So this is an example of an on-pause image or a surface image of the ear. And this is a cross-sectional image where you can see various structures like the temporal membrane, the basilar membrane, the textural membrane. And so essentially when sound comes in, it causes these membranes to vibrate. And what we're trying to understand is the relative motion of these different vibrating structures and how that, again, can connect back to the specific sounds that are being heard. So one of the studies that we've been working on is looking at how sound is encoded as a function of its intensity, how sound is encoded as a function of the time delay in which the sound is received. And these types of phase maps are telling us a lot about new information about the mechanics of the ear that actually haven't been able to be studied before because the existing technologies for studying this are all invasive and require adding structures to the ear that are going to change its mechanics, which then is going to compromise the integrity of the data that we obtain. So that's a little bit about the work that we do. So as I mentioned, our goal is to really develop new imaging technologies that allow us to detect disease and look at disease at the earliest stages so that we can then build new therapeutics that are ultimately going to be helpful for patients in the long run. But I want to just take a few moments before I close to talk about a little bit where my faith comes in as I work on this book. So there are three elements of my faith that I really want to share with you that have been really important as I walk this journey of being a professor. I think oftentimes as scientists, we really value knowledge and the pursuit of knowledge. And I think that for a lot of us, our work really leads us to wonder. You know, I remember when I was a postdoc, I would walk across campus and I would just think, wow, my work is worship. Like just being able to study these things and to see and reveal the structures that God has made. The Bible says, it is the glory of God to hide a matter and the glory of kings to search it out, right? That's really what I feel like we're doing in the context of our work. We're kind of playing this game of hide and seek with God and he's enjoying it and we're enjoying it and it's really fun. And so I think this idea that we are, in this state of wonder constantly is really important. But I think the other thing that sometimes we can forget is that God calls us not just to wonder, but to also depend on him. You know, we are intended to live by his word and to walk by his word. And I think sometimes as scientists, we can think so intellectually that we can forget that even in our intellectual pursuits, we need to find ways to depend on God. And so one of the elements of my faith that I think has become really important to where I am is just this dependence on God. I think the more I study, I think it's true for all of us, the more we learn, the more we realize we don't know. And but the Bible says that if we lack wisdom, that we can ask God, and he gives it generously to all of us. And I know in my work every day, I feel like I lack wisdom, and I need to pray to God for instruction on how to run this experiment, and what experiment to do, and what types of things I should be looking for. when I was a graduate student, I would go around my lab and I would pray over my equipment because I was like, oh, I don't know how to make this work. Please make this work for me. And I still do that, and I still pray for my, you know, I pray for my students as well. And I think that one of the legacies that we're called to leave in our work is not just a trail of new scientific data, but just a legacy of having, you know, students who've encountered us, who we've prayed for. You know, I've often thought, you know, for some of my students, there might not be anyone else in the world who's praying for them, right? And how seriously are we taking that charge to really take care of the people that God has entrusted around us? How seriously are we using our work, which we spend so much time on, as a mechanism for us to learn how to depend on God? The next thing I think we've heard a lot about during this conference is this idea of humility. And one of the verses that comes to mind for me here is that of Philippians 2, verses 3 to 4. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. Here again, this is somewhere where I realize, you know, as a faculty member, I can walk into my office and so easily think, you know, the school is supposed to revolve around me and around my interests, and, you know, you grant proposal person, please get this grant done and help me get it in the way it should be, right? But again, we're interacting with people, and people are so valuable to God. And how often do we take the time to really be humble and to realize that it's not just, you know, it's not just about us, and the work that we do, really, God has put us there for a reason. And I think it's really important. I think this verse comes to mind so often for me when I think about dealing with my admin assistant. You know, I am challenged all of the time to make sure that I am acting in a state of humility before her, because, you know, she's as valuable to God as I am, as we all are. And the people who are around us, you know, I think it's just really worth remembering that God has placed us there for a purpose, and that purpose is to act differently from those around us, and that often means being humble in ways and at times when it might not often seem common. The last element of faith I want to mention is that of perspective. And I don't quite have a verse for this, but something that really struck me, I don't know, something that God had spoke to me a long time ago that really has, one, helped motivate my work, but two, helped motivate my work, has been the following phrase, which I had taped on my door and I used to look at every time I walked out of the house. People are dying. What are you doing about it? And that was a really convicting statement for me. And I work in a field where my goal is to try to seek out and search out new technologies that are intended to help people's lives get better. And so for me, this was so motivating because every time I went to work, I was thinking about how I need to be helping people. Every time I write a grant, I'm so passionate because I know that if this gets funded, it's really going to be able to help someone have a better life and live a better life. But at one point, I realized that even the best of us, and I'm not the best in my field by far, the best that I can do, the best that anyone can do, the best that the Nobel Prize winners in my field can do, is extend someone's life for a little while, make life a little bit better. And that was really sobering when I thought about that, because the best I can do is maybe make someone live another year, another 7 years maybe. Is that all that there is? When I think about what healthcare means, this is the wiki definition, by the way. So healthcare is the maintenance or improvement of health via the diagnosis, treatment, or prevention of disease, illness, injury, and impairments. When I think about that, and I'm in the field of healthcare, or at least trying to make a difference in healthcare, and I think about the things that I'm working on, the cancers of the body, you know, I really had to step back and take a bigger perspective, because I realized actually, the types of cancers that I work on are not the only types of cancers that we have in the world. In fact, the biggest cancer of this whole world is sin, right? Everyone is suffering, everyone is dying, everyone is in need of better health care. And the Bible tells us that too, right? For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and all are justified freely by his grace through the redemption of Jesus Christ. And so I think about the work that I do, and I think about the best that I can do. But then I think about the best that Christ can do, right? Christ ultimately is the solution for the cancer that is invading this whole world. Jesus said, and it was said earlier, while I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. And Jesus isn't here anymore, but he said that we are the light of the world, that we are a town built on a hill that cannot be hidden. And so I just want to end this time by reminding myself, by reminding all of us, that no matter if we're in science or medicine or I'm someone teaching English, we're actually all in the business of healthcare because the whole world around us actually is dying. And the only solution that we have that's actually a purposeful and meaningful solution is Jesus Christ. And so we all share a common call. As Christians, we have the capacity to imagine a brighter future for healthcare because we have the capacity to understand what is on the other side of death, right? This time of no more pain, no more sorrow. That's the bigger experience that really is the model, the ideal outcome for any situation. And we as Christians as well, we're also called to be light. And not only light, we're also called to be God's image bearers. He said that in his word. So we're also intended to image a better future for other people in this regard. So people are dying. What are you going to do about it? Thank you.
Treat you, because in my case, I was the same way, not the best scientist. They say, oh, of course you can be humble. You're not the best person.
Yeah, I think that's a great question and something that I've struggled with as well, because I feel like, there was a time when I would really pray and cry out to God, feeling like the only way that I can make a difference was to be the best. And feeling that if I wasn't the best, that I was actually failing God, which felt like a really big fail. As far as my openness to my faith, I am quite open about my faith to everyone who asks, and I'm not shy at all about sharing that I'm a Christian. In fact, when I took the job, as I mentioned, the only reason I took the job was because I felt it was a call from God. And I remember when I got there, I thought, God, if I'm not going to be any different from other people here, there's no point in my being here. And so I felt from the very beginning that I didn't want to wait necessarily until I got tenure, for example, to reveal that I'm a Christian. And personally, I honestly haven't experienced writing tensions around my faith. It's not something that's come up in common dialogue, so I haven't had to fight those battles. But I do, for example, when I teach classes, often I'll share at the beginning of the class a little bit about my background and what I do and when I do my free time. I'll mention that I, I go to church and that I, participate in church groups. The students in my lab, there are students who are Christians, and so, we've talked together. I have students who are Muslim, and we've talked together. And recently, I think one of the biggest witnesses that I hope I had was I got married last year, and I was very intentional in planning my wedding that I wanted it to reflect my faith. And I invited my students purposefully, and I don't think anyone who attended my wedding had any question about where I stand with my faith. And I've engaged like in a varsity group on campus to some degree as well, and I've been openly involved, but yeah.
Thank you.
Very lovely talk. So my question is a scientific one. you compared healthy skin and the carcinoma, but what about what the dermatologist and the pathologist is looking at is usually not, I mean, they know what healthy looks like versus those comparing to the non-cancer.
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's actually the next step of the study. So for the data that we were able to collect so far, at least from the, so for the mouse samples, it was easy to collect cancer because we have a mouse model for the cancer. For the human skin, we didn't have a protocol that would allow us to just biopsy normal samples that looked suspicious. So we were only, the protocol that we were working with was in the context of a surgery where people had already been diagnosed with cancer, so we knew all of the data that we were getting were cancer, or we were using mainly healthy skin that was adjacent to where the cancerous regions were. So for our next in vivo study, one of the things that is really important, since we don't need to puncture the skin in order to do the testing, we can now start to look at other abnormalities that are not necessarily cancerous or that are suspicious for cancer, test what they're going to look like, and then have the dermatologist carry out their normal standard of care to determine if it's going to be cancerous or not, and make that final determination. We have evidence based on some preliminary studies that we should still be able to distinguish that we should still be able to distinguish between them, but you're right, that's one thing that we haven't tested yet.
One more question?
I'm curious, how often do you just find a tumor that's just benign? What percentage are cancerous compared to benign?
Yeah, so in our study, as I just mentioned, we actually didn't have any non-cancerous tumors. However, in the clinic that we work in, for example, one of the reasons, the data we were collecting was from Mohs surgery. So in Mohs surgery, the procedure is a person goes in for biopsy, they determine that they have cancer, they come back later for surgery, which is to remove the cancer. The first step in removing the cancer during that surgery is to do another kind of shaving of the initial surface of the skin, and they're basically shaving deeper and deeper and deeper until they remove all of the cancer that remains. In our facility, 25% of the people who are referred for Mohs surgery have no residual signs of cancer when they come back. So that initial biopsy actually was already sufficient to be able to remove all of the cancer that was there. So that's not exactly the same as something that's benign, but there are a lot of unnecessary biopsies that are still happening, even in the therapeutic suite. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Yeah, I just have one quick question. I know that part of your mission is to get that technology to underserved areas. And I know you're not at that point yet in your research, but if you could fast forward today and you could start reaching out to those underserved areas, where would you go or what techniques would you use?
Sure. So I didn't talk about it. We actually have a few projects that we're working on that are along those lines. They use very different technologies, so I didn't quite incorporate them here. So I think there are two target areas. So one of them is I think about healthcare in the United States. So there are a lot of underserved areas here that just don't have the facilities and resources. So some of the technologies that we work on, a first step is to make them simple enough or cheap enough to be able to be used even here in the US. But then the next step, I think, is to take some of these technologies and take them abroad. So I do have one project that we're working on with a faculty member who's in the infectious diseases department. So he studies waterborne diseases in Africa. So some of the technologies that we're working on would be used in various parts of Africa where there are high viral loads and other bacteria and other things like that. And then my kind of personal story is my parents in their older age have actually started to become a lot more interested in missions work. And so they do a lot of work in Africa. And so every time I publish something, my dad's like, can you bring this over here? And can we take this? When is it available? And I'm like, it's not tested yet. But I think it'll be really, really to be able to partner with, some of the ministries that my parents are already connected with and try to deliver medical care.
All right, well, thank you very much. I think we have a refreshment break right now, and then it looks like the air is on in here, so we'll come back in here for the session afterwards. So thank you again.
Audrey, thanks so much. That was the two, you know, the integration of your faith and your life.
Are you going to put me out of work?
Are you a doctor?
Tough though.
This is mine. I'm just kind of double checking. And he said he wants his computer.
Oh, are you going to be swapping it?
I have so few pictures of people because I don't own any of that.